Okay, anyway, today is November the 3rd, 2014, and it's very fascinating material will be picked up during the Shia. So where are we at? We're at that the Rav loses out on his great dream to be president of Yeshiva University. Rabbi Belkin is elected. And in retrospect, it turns out to be a tremendous blessing for the Rav, but not such a great blessing for Dr. Belkin. What's fascinating is that they supplement each other, they complement each other. They work out a very wonderful relationship. And the Rav, who begins unknown to a certain degree, unwanted, with opposition and everything we've spoken about over the years and published about and did movies about, little by little he becomes the Rav. And Dr. Belkin can handle the presidency because the Rav takes a lot of the pressure off him. And I showed you questions that came up that were earth-shaking. That in Rabbi Revel's time, Rabbi Revel would have been involved. The question, for instance, synagogue council, which is an earth-shaking question. It's a problem that haunts us until today. How do we relate to conservative reform? How do we relate to non-Orthodox Jews? This problem goes back to Germany, 1876, with the secession law that enabled Rav Shmuel von Hirsch to leave the general community, the general Gemeinde, and organize his own kihilat, and yet have recognition from the government. See, in Germany, that was important because the government gave funds to the synagogues. And until 1876, they recognized one Jewish community, one Catholic community, one Protestant community. And now they have to recognize two different Jewish communities, and that required a law in parliament. And this problem lives on until today. I might want to add one thought that I didn't mention last week, but I think it's very important because a student spoke with me after class, and I realized that perhaps this thought can help clarify the contemporary position. When the OU at the OU convention, when it was announced that the synagogue council had disbanded and the whole question of synagogue council was now behind us, and Rabbi Stopler made a Shechayanu. So later that year, I was walking with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. He was in a wheelchair. I was walking next to him. His son, Rav Yosef, was pushing the wheelchair. And we were discussing contemporary issues. So I said to Rav Aaron, "Was freuen wir sich? Why are we so happy that the synagogue council ended, if after all, your brother, my Rebbe, was totally in favor with the strictures that he had put on it, but he was in favor?" So Rav Aaron said to me, "It's a good question, but he thinks that the key to understanding the difference is how far reform and conservative have changed." And Rav Aaron said, "Who would ever dream that the reform movement would recognize patrilineal lineage is makes you Jewish?" So right away, today I would say half the reform movement is probably not even halachically Jewish, maybe even more than half. Who would ever dream that the conservative movement would recognize homosexuality as being normative? And he said, "The difference between us is so great that even my brother would admit today we cannot stand together as one body." All right, it's guessing what Rav Soloveitchik, Mori Rebbe, would hold, but that's what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said to me. And ultimately, you can understand that no one is even raising the issue today, let's get the conservative, reform, and Orthodox together. But this concept that Rabbi Belkin handled the yeshiva, Rabbi Belkin enabled the growth of the yeshiva, as we will see, and the Rav took the heat away from him. This is absolutely so, and it explains why it was a perfect relationship between the Rav and the president, between the Rav and the president and Rosh Yeshiva. Now, the Rav himself, let's just spend a few more minutes talking about the Rav. It's another interesting factor here, which you look at the Rav and you look at Rabbi Belkin. Rabbi Belkin was a wonderful Rebbe. Rabbi Belkin had a lot of mitleid, how do you say that in English? Compassion, understanding, empathy. Rabbi Belkin suffered in his life. Remember what I told you, his father was blown away before his eyes. He came from a large family. The poverty was indescribable. He shared shoes with Rav Shimon Rum when they were in yeshiva together. He shared a cot with Rav Shimon Rum. They shared a bed. One day one of them slept on the bed, the other day one of them slept on the floor. I mean, it's beyond words. So if you yet knew Reb Shmuel Belkin's Talmidim, they loved him. They loved him. He was a wonderful Rebbe. The Rav, on the other hand, as we said last week, had never attended a yeshiva. The Rav never had any interaction with peers as a kid. The Rav was a genius, educated by his father, who was a genius. The grandson of Reb Chaim Brisker, who was a genius. The grandson of Reb Elia Prujana, who was a genius. So you see, when you deal with the Rav, you're dealing with an individual who never really experienced the real world. And what I'm touching upon here is an unbelievable question that you have to face with bright children. All of you know there's a concept of home-tutored children. I think in Israel too, I'm not certain, but I know in America, in many states, you can get away without sending your child to school. Is that good? Is it bad? Home tutor. I think in Israel too it can be worked out. It's terrible, because the reason we go to school, I hate to say it, is besides everything is you will learn in school, and a bright kid will learn very little. All he'll learn is the basic rudiments, and the rest he's going to do on his own. It's like Shas and Paiskim, like when I spoke about yesterday in class when we dealt with Hukam Paskin and the Reb Menashe Klein and the Pasquilas and who's in favor of the Erev, who's against the Erev. Ibmani Shalalim, what did I tell you? I told you when I meet a student of more than 50 years ago, I apologize to him. Vic, why do I apologize? Remember what I said, because I knew nothing, Fister. What did I know? I knew 100 Daf Gemara, and I knew a little bit of Yoredeya. All right, today, 50 plus years later, I'm not ashamed to tell you I know a lot more than I knew when I got smicha from the yeshiva. And I don't want you to think I was an Oislav Shmuley, that I was, one of the stupid kids. I was not one of the stupid kids. I was a star. I was Baruch Hashem. You didn't sit next to the Rav unless you had guts. Take my word for it. He could blow you away. I'm going to give you a source. I'm going to quote something in a few minutes. The Rav, these parts of life passed him by. So when he becomes a Rebbe, he was a genius. He was demanding. He had a temper. He was the Rav. And on that level, it was an ongoing conflict between two desires of a Talmud. On one hand, his desire was to gain as much as possible from Reb Chaim Zainikel. On the other hand, a Talmud needs a Rebbe, needs warmth, needs love, I would say. And certainly not in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, did you get that from the Rav. And it's an amazing thing when you think about it. Rabbi Belkin would have been on the second level an unbelievable Rebbe. And Dafka Rabbi Belkin is the one who's pushed out of the classroom, and the Rav is the one who remains in the classroom. Now, there's no question that as far as a teacher, no one equaled the Rav. He was the Rebbe par excellence. for his classes. But as far as his ability to get along with students, it was a problem. And here let me quote something to you in the Rav. They claim these are the Rav's own words. I heard this from the Rav myself in different contexts, so I will accept it. Again, the source of what I'm about to quote is foggy. What do I mean it's foggy? Yitz Rubin sent this to my neighbor Shmuel Hershkowitz. It is credited to Basil Herring, Rabbi Herring, who had been the executive vice president of the RCA for many years, that he wrote this up. And all of you know on the computer, endless shayurim of the Rav circulate. At times, you have no idea where they're from, when they were said, what was the year, what language did the Rav say it in, is it a translation? But here, I cannot give you the source. It's written up on regret, annulment, and the essence of tshuva. And right, Yitzchak, you sent it to Sam Dershowitz, okay? Do you know where it's from? What tshuva drasha? What year?
Oh, it's just what's written there.
Yeah, but it doesn't give a source.
Oh, it came from Gil Student's blog.
All right, I understand it. You picked it up from Gil Student's blog, but there's no source on what was printed out.
You have to write a letter to that.
No, beside that, but this is the Rav. And the Rav is talking about tshuva. Moreover, tshuva requires one to disassociate from the self that performed those earlier acts. One must feel that the person committing these actions was not the real me because I gave in to an out-of-character impulse. Take, for instance, someone who suffers from uncontrollable anger. I myself used to be subject to angry outbursts, which after much hard work over many years, I have learned to keep under control for the most part. This is the Rav speaking about himself. Although even now I get angry, when someone kriegt me a rein in my cup. It's a little hard to translate. When someone crawls into my head, if we would say, I grew up with the expression, kriegt me a rein in beina. You've heard that, into my bones. You follow? But in the days when I would be overwhelmed with such outbursts, I would, after a while, experience deep remorse, with a feeling that I've been overtaken by an alien spirit or possessed by a demon or what Hasidim call a dibuk. It is similar to when a person acts under the influence of an intoxicant and does things that he would normally never do. And this is the Rav. I heard him speaking once, I heard him via tape, many decades later, speaking at Maria Synagogue. And at Maria Synagogue, he also gets involved with anger. And he says, I know occasionally I go into angry outbursts, he says, and I'm trying my best to control myself. I'm working on myself. I'm giving myself musa, but I haven't entirely succeeded. And the audience breaks into tremendous laughter. Now, I don't know if Boston...
How were they laughing? He was really burying his neshama.
Right, no, but they break into laughter when he says that I've tried very hard, but I don't know whether I've entirely succeeded. And, you know, the laughter is the same to Rebbe. We know you haven't entirely succeeded. But you see, it's very fascinating when you think about it. Rabbi Belkin had the personality for the total Rosh Yeshiva. The Rav excelled on the first level. No one could equal him, but there was always this tension in the classroom. Now, Vic Yellen, I want to quote Vic's take on the Rav. Vic is very insightful. And Vic says, though he could accept the classic reference of Talmud for Rebbe, he was unable to allow himself the joy of believing that his Talmidim also loved him as a person. person. The Talmidim understood that if the teacher's mind seemed stern and rigorously unrelenting, the man was in fact warm, even gentle and forgiving. And you see, here you come to the difference between the Rav as a Rebbe and the Rav as an individual. As a Rebbe, he was all genius, he was all demanding. He wanted the most, the best of his Talmidim. He couldn't deal with human foibles. He couldn't deal with the kid who learned the Tosfos and couldn't understand the depth of the Tosfos. He couldn't. He could fly off the handle. In class, he got carried away and he said shtuyat, he let you have it in Yiddish, you know, and then and you were sitting there, you were sittering, you were shaking, you were shivering. But what was amazing was, out of class, when you approached him as an individual, he was a totally different person. He was more the Boston person than the New York person, if you read me. And you see that and feel it and experience it time and again. There was this dichotomy between the all-demanding teacher who was on such a superior level that he had trouble dealing with the normative individual. But as a human being, he was second to none. Many times when you asked him a shaila and he couldn't be makir, you could see it troubled him. He was bothered. The sensitivity that he had was overwhelming. Now, and let me go one step further and bring it down into modern problems. I'm just listening to the Rav speaking. It must be in this, maybe this late 60s, early 70s. He's speaking in Boston to the Chevra Shas, and he's presenting a major paper. Or maybe it's Saturday night in Boston. He's presenting a major paper on Yetziat Mitzrayim. And evidently feminism is hitting away at the time. And he deals with the role that the women played in Yetziat Mitzrayim. Without little Miriam, there would have never been a Moshe Rabbeinu. There never would have been a Yetziat Mitzrayim. And he says, I'm not playing to the crowd. It's not because feminism is an issue, he says. But I'm absolutely telling the truth as Chazal understood a man and a woman. And Vic Yeller here, and I'm going to add to Vic now, Vic Yeller tells a story, this is page 265, that one of the sons of the administrators of the yeshiva was getting married. I don't know whose wedding it was. And the Rav is coming in from Boston to the Sadeh Kedushin, and they asked Vic to pick the Rav, since Vic lived in Forest Hills, and the Rav was coming to JFK, or LaGuardia, no, excuse me, probably LaGuardia, yeah, LaGuardia Airport. They asked Vic to pick up the Rav and bring him to the wedding. So the Vic, with his wife Hanya, they should live and be well, go to the airport, pick up the Rav. So first of all, the Rav doesn't even want to sit next to Vic. He wants Hanya, you sit next to your husband. No, she insists, all right, be the Evid. The Rav sits next to Vic and Hanya goes to the back of the car. They reach the hall, and what do you have to do when you have a car? You have to park it. So Vic leaves the Rav and Hanya, you go into the wedding. And the Rav remains with Hanya in the anteroom, the chamber, before you come into the main hall, and everyone is around the Rav. Rebbe, how are you? Rebbe this, Rebbe that. And the Rav does not leave go of Hanya. She's standing next to him, and the Rav is with her, and he says, no, I have a responsibility. Only when Vic comes back, the Rav says to Vic, all right, I've now discharged my responsibility. You left me to take care of your wife. Now I can go into the wedding hall. And he had this respect for women, this dignity. And now I'll tell you a story that was told to me, but he pleaded me not to write it up. All right, I didn't write it up, but it's a story. One of the YU Rosh Yeshiva, he's not a YU product, he's a musmach of Moshe Feinstein, I believe, but he's one of the group that gathered around the Rav in the 70s, and he became very, very close to the Rav. And his sister, it came from, I don't want to mention his name, but not that there's anything wrong, but if he told me not to publish it, but the story is absolutely true. He confirmed it years later when I spoke with him again. So it's a fabulous story. And he came from an Ungarische home, a Hungarian home. His father, Talmud Chacham, a businessman, a Yerei v'Shalem. Shabbos morning after Kiddush, the father sat down and learned Gemara with his sons. No daughter was allowed in. Women, mandachan shemeh. What do women have to do with learning Gemara? Women in the kitchen preparing the meal. A traditional Hungarian approach. And this girl was very bright. She goes to Barnard. And in Barnard, she starts to have questions already about religion and challenging and an attitude towards women. And while she's having these problems, these questions, and bothering her brother, a Talmud Chacham, there's a family wedding. So her brother says to her, you know what? Come uptown from Barnard to Yeshiva. And when I'm finished here, I'll drive you to the air. We'll drive to the wedding together. So he finishes shir. This is, what do they call it? Reuben Hall, am I right? That's the name of the building on the side. No, First Hall. Baruch Hashem, I've been out of YU so long, I get confused occasionally. First, I should remember that. First was first. You remember first, remember Rabbi First? It was his uncle who donated the money. Milti First's uncle, evidently did very well in business, donated the money, First Hall. And the Rebbe, her brother, is coming down with the Rav in the elevator. They both finish here at the same time. They come out of the elevator and she runs over to her brother and he introduces her to Rabbi Soloveitchik. And she says, and he says, Rebbe, this is my sister, is her name. And he says to his sister, let's say Gloria, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik. They reach the door, everyone stands aside, and they're holding the door for the Rav to go out. And the Rav says, ladies first. And he doesn't budge until Gloria walks out of First Hall. At that moment, her brother told me all her questions about Torah and modernity disappeared, evaporated in 1 second flat. This was the Rav. Now, this description of the Rav was accurate until the 70s. Unfortunately, life has a way of humbling most people. I say most because I've met individuals, Chazal have a statement that is so true that women, even in their old age, continue to put on makeup. That's a very profound, I knew a lady, a very elegant lady, and she taught myself and my wife something we never forgot. She lived, that family was blessed with longevity. Her mother lived till 102. She made it to 96, 97, quite active. President of Amit Women, her daughter was president of Amit Women. Big Balei Tzedaka, Slonim HaChassidim, with their origins. One of the buildings in Slonim is dedicated in her honor, in her memory, her husband's memory. And she was well into her 90s, and she said, very important for a woman to constantly put on makeup. And she says, certainly my age, that I have to go to the hospital occasionally, very important. So, you know, very innocently, I asked why. And she said, if you don't have makeup on, they're going to look at you, an old lady, you know, we're not going to work so hard to save her life. She's in her 90s. Makeup, she's an old lady, but she's young. She has life left in her. It's a meridik fun. So, paraphrasing Chazal, I want to tell you, there's still some arrogant people that one step away from death, they're still arrogant. But for most normal people, life has a way of making you humble. And you see what's sad about the Rav when you talk about the Rav, and this is very, very sad actually for us who wears Talmidim and fear him, but yet learn to love him. You learn to love him. The Rav was the Rav. He never had a normal life. He never had a normal world. He never went to school. He never horsed around with kids his age. He never played a game of baseball, I'm quite certain. Although it could be in Chayder, in Chaslovich, he did play some games. I have it in the Rav, the world of. So, Lo Aleinu, we had tremendous tragedy. 1959, 1960, he was diagnosed with an illness that at that time was practically fatal, and he had a major, major operation, and he thought he could have been on his deathbed. He spoke about it. The Rebbe had a way of revealing his innermost. He said, I'll never forget it, a Yotzai Drasha, when he, that year there was no Yotzai Drasha, but a year later when he was starting to fully recover, he said, a person, what does he want out of God? At first, his wishes are so small. All I asked the Ribbono Shel Olam for was I should live to see my daughter's wedding. It was Tova and Rabban Lichtenstein. They delayed their wedding for the Rav to recover enough to come to the wedding. Okay? And he says, then when I started to feel better, I not only wanted this and I wanted that, I wanted more and more. You know, we're showing a human being our desires. But that operation, and then of course he went through the terrible tragedy of a triple avelut in 1967. First his mother died, then his brother died, and then his wife died. And you all know that he couldn't even observe the avelut for his brother. It was just heartbreaking because he had to shave. Whenever he visited his wife in the hospital, he had to put shoes on. He had to make believe everything was normal. His wife died not knowing that Rav Shmuel died. Okay, and bear that in mind. By the way, that's lahalacha. Look into the Hashulchan. I mean, what the Rav did was absolutely a pialacha. Not that he needs the Hashulchan's consent. But the Aruch HaShulchan actually deals with it. And he didn't want to aggravate his wife, and she would look down. Let's say she would look down, sit up and look down and see he didn't have shoes on. She would say right away, Beryl, Avu Zayin Deshich, well, why are you wearing house shoes? Why are you wearing, what's going on? What is it, Yom Kippur today? And he had to shave. She couldn't see him unshaven. And it was heart-rending and heartbreaking. And then came Churban HaBayit, as the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Bet, that if your wife dies or your husband dies, it's Churban HaBayit B'Yomam. No, go tell that to the youngsters today with all the divorce going on, what marriage is all about. My wife and I, we're still in a state of shock from what we see and what I've seen, including my own students. God have mercy, including my own students from BMT, from elsewhere, from the Kollel, not as bad, but the Kollel as well. Lo aleinu, lo aleinu. Okay. So this already, lo aleinu, humbled the Rav, and it turned him in to a human being like every other human being. And the Talmidim of the 70s already, it was a different Rav. He didn't get angry. Chaim Soloveitchik talks about this, that he was sitting in a shir of his father in the 70s when he came back from Israel to help take care of his father. His father was ill already, needed help. And he was walking out of shir, and he says to Reb Heschel Shapley, he says, Heschel, since when does my father tolerate such nonsense? I'm paraphrasing it. There's an exact quote, but this is the thing, you know. Some guy said his father in class that had he said it in my time, his head would have been chopped off. But he said it in the 70s, when it was a different Rav, and he got away with it. The Rav did not come. So it's an interesting story, who the Rav was, where he came from. And you know, you can sum it up with two factual statements about the Rav and Rav Moshe, his father. And I think it says it all. One statement is very simple. the Rav constantly, and remember we spoke about this, he revealed his heart in public lectures. The Israeli mentality couldn't tolerate it. When Al HaTshuva came out, people said to me, how could the Rav talk about his father, his mother, his wife, his children in public? Because he it was amazing. In private, he was a very private individual, but in public, he revealed the innermost emotions. If I know how to be a human being, and I try to be a human being, a good deal of it is because of Rebbe. When he revealed his emotions, you learned what it means to be a father, a mother, a husband, a wife, a child, a parent. If people understood the Rav, psychologists would go out of business, if you know what I'm talking about. So, what did the Rav say? My father never kissed me. Could you imagine? My father never kissed me. If you look into Washington, you'll understand why I'm sitting here. It's a direct result. My father never kissed me, but the kiss I got from the Rav. But as I've told you more than once, I don't write it that strongly because no one will believe me. I just say he embraced me, he hugged me. But Rav Heschel Schechter will testify that every word I write there is correct because he was sitting right next to us when it happened. So my father never kissed me. And on the other hand, this is the same father that I heard from Talmidim of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, that when he started teaching in yeshiva in 1930, the first year was December 1929, if I'm correct. I'll ask Yomo to consult the Bible known as Bernard Revel, Builder of American Jewish Orthodoxy, and see if I have it right. December 1929, he started teaching. The Rav doesn't arrive in America to 32. Every time he gave the Shia, he would say over, and mein Sohn der Gaon, my son der Gaon, my son der Gaon. He would say over from the Rav. When they asked him a difficult question, he said, this is the answer I gave, but my son gave a better answer. And he would quote the Rav. So you see, here is the Rav. He grew up. It's abnormal. Your father never kissed you. And on the other hand, the father is boasting about you to the world, mein Sohn der Gaon. And this was the Rav, this was the Rebbe. This was his uniqueness, his personality, his success, and his difficulty as well. But for Rabbi Belkin, and now we return to Rabbi Belkin, he was a perfect partner. Until the 70s, there was never a major issue between them. He drew the fire away from Rabbi Belkin. He enabled Rabbi Belkin to build, to live in his world, to create, to dream, to take a little yeshiva and a little yeshiva college and turn it into the massive institution that it was to become. Now, let's talk about Rabbi Belkin. And I'm going to show you shortly, give you a source that you'll never forget. And you see, life, success, there's a price you pay for it. There's a price you pay for it. People think, you know, success, wonderful, great. And your young people, the youngsters here, the older people sitting here understand me well. And you know, you're young people, you look, I want to succeed, but you have no idea. At times with fame and glory comes a heavy individual price, a heavy individual sacrifice. It's not black and white. Sometimes is the fame and glory worth it? It's a difficult question. If we don't have ego and don't have fame and glory, the Jewish people achieve nothing. We need our leaders. We need our greatness. We need our Rabbeim, Rosh Yeshiva. But the personal price, very difficult. You don't have to go any further than my lectures in Das Teira when I spoke about Reb Mordechai Gifter. No one loved Eretz Yisrael more than Reb Mordechai Gifter and his wife. And yet they were ordered back to Tells. Tells would disappear. And look at the price he paid. He had to leave Israel, lived in a dormitory what was it? I gave you the exact figure, what, the last 20 years of his life approximately, maybe a drop less, lived in a dormitory, because any day he can return to Israel, return to Eretz Yisrael, and it never happened. He died in America. So you'll see in a second. Okay, now, Rabbi Belkin now becomes president of the yeshiva. He is inheriting a title from Rabbi Revel as president in Rosh Yeshiva. In reality, the beauty of the position is diminished, meaning Rabbi Belkin has to give up the classroom. And this hurts. No longer has time to prepare. No longer has time to teach. Rabbi Revel, despite all the vicissitudes of life and challenges of the yeshiva, managed to give a weekly shiur to the smicha students in yeshiva, Rav Yitzchok Chanan, till the day he died. The final stroke he suffered was during a shiur he was giving, November 1940. In the shiur, he took ill. Rabbi Belkin had to give it up. But nevertheless, his love for Torah, his love for the Litvisha world in which he grew up, was part of his very being. And he did something that was a tremendous chesed that, let me tell you about it. Vic Geller writes a little about it, I saw with my own eyes. And historians who write about Rabbi Belkin should research it a bit more if it's possible, because this is a pure act of chesed. And here you have to understand, the survivors come to America. Do you have any idea how difficult it is to come to a strange country with a different language, with a different lifestyle? Aliyah is infinitely easier for one simple reason. This is a country of Olim Chadashim. There's very few people here who have been here more than three generations. And the country is built on the concept, Mi Oleh Le'oleh Kocheinu Oleh. The country is built on that concept. Everyone will tell you about his roots, his origins. All right, one day we're going to have Nusach Achid here. We can take bets now. Will it be in 100 years, 150 years, 136 years? We're a long way from Nusach Achid, although we're a lot closer than we were 50 years ago. I remember in the army when I did basic training, so we had Nusach Achid. So I said a vod afterwards that the only Nusach Achid about our basic training was you never knew what Nusach the Chazan would daven in until he opened his mouth. Today you actually have shuls in Israel where Shachris is Ashkenaz and Musaf is Sfat. And it's very interesting. I know a number of shuls like this already where you're intermingling, because we're intermarrying. It's amazing what's going on. But this is a country that is geared to the fact Americans have come in, Anglos have put in from Canada, from Australia, from South Africa. The French are now taking over the country. The Russians had their share. And everyone adds to the Moroccans. And you understand yourself, the way we dress, the way we act, the way we eat, the way we learn. Who in America would open up a Vajisvaram in a Litvish yeshiva? Today, in every yeshiva in Israel, if you don't have all of Rav Avadya Svarim, you're lacking. It's a different world. It's integration. So here, true, you're an Olech Hadash, you don't speak the language. All right, I have a principle. I will only speak Hebrew to Israelis. They'll break into English because they hear my American accent. Fine, I will not lower myself to speak that vile language of the American commonwealth known as English to Israelis. Anachnu medavrim b'lashon hakodesh. All right, to Americans I speak English. Someone says, it's a vile language or not. If the State Department can talk the way they talk, I will stand on what I just said. It's a vile language. Modern Hebrew is based upon Lashon HaKodesh. Baruch Hashem, unfortunately, it's based upon English as well. Atalo fair. What's wrong with saying Atalo Hagun? If you say Atalo Hagun, they'll arrest you for desecration of airspace. Atalo fair. But what can I do? Chazal have many words in it, Greek and Latin. Rashi has many words, Old French. Am I right or wrong? Follow me? Okay, Alex? So I have to put up with modern Hebrew. I'm proud to say it is based upon Lashon HaKodesh, but not entirely. But you know what it's like to come to America, a Litvish yeshiva bacher who survived the war. What do you do for Panasa? What do you do for Panasa? So some of them got jobs teaching, and I with my own life, I owe to the Shanghai crowd that came to Solanta, Gedolei Yisrael, teaching 7th and 8th grade in a yeshiva day school where 90% of the kids were gangsters and the other 10% were, if they weren't gangsters, they were charlatans, okay? So in here you take these people, in English, they don't speak a word of English, and you put them in. So you should know that Rabbi Belkin opened the kollel. And this was the first kollel that Yeshiva University ever had. It was not a kollel for the sake of a kollel like the kollelim of today. Like I said yesterday, YU has 5 kollelim. I can't believe it. We're one of them. We're one of 5. 5 different. Each one has a different tafkid and a different purpose. And this is a Torah Mada kollel. And this is a Torah Oni kollel. And this is a Chveis a Torah Bahaskala kollel. A Torah in Bernard Revel Graduate School kollel. And Gris kollel, a unique kollel. YU has 5 kollelim. This was a kollel to support these Litvisha Talmidei Chachamim until they could find jobs, acclimate on the American scene. It's an amazing thing. Some of them later go on to college. One of them later becomes a professor of Professor Peretz, Rabbi Rubin. Do you remember what he was? Was it physics? He's a genius. He had a master's in fact. Was it physics? Physics, I believe. Physics. He was a Litvisha. Within a few years, he conquered America. He taught in the Yeshiva College. Didn't give a shir. A Litvisha Talmid Chacham was a professor of physics. And this kollel was headed by one of the YU Resh Yeshiva, Rabbi Avigdor Zipperstein. Rabbi Avigdor Zipperstein, anyone recognize the name? He was a grandson of Rabbi Rinus, the founder of Mizrahi. And if you go, he lived in Kew Gardens Hills, if I'm not mistaken. If you go to Beverly Hills in Beth Jacob, there's a Lakewood Kollel that's headed up by a great-great-great-grandson of the founder of Mizrahi, of Rabbi Yitzchak Rinus. It's an amazing thing. When I met him, what can I do? I'm a big Zionist, so I'm a chutzpan. So I said to him, what is an einikol of Rav Rinus doing in Beverly Hills when there's a state of Israel? It's Tate de Satre. But you don't ask those questions because you're not going to get good answers and you just offend people. So I had to low-key, all right, being Mabit's Torah, creating Jews. The more Jews we create, the more we will have in Israel, ultimately, because good Jews come in Aliyah. Ah, my dear students. While this was happening, here's Rabbi Belkin. All right, you have the Kollel. People are being... I remember looking in this Kollel. You know where the Kollel met? Across the street from Yeshiva, there were little buildings that were built after World War II by the United States government to help students. It was part of the GI Bill of Rights. One of those buildings housed Bernard Revel Graduate School. In that building, that's where the Kollel met. There was like a little base medrash, And you saw, for us it was shocking, mature men in their late 20s, early 30s, not working, sitting and learning. You understand, it was a different world then, the 50s. And this was the kol of Rabbi Belkin organized, so they should have panas, pure chesed. But he's also building the university. And you see, the more he builds, the greater the distance he creates between himself and the student body. The Rav, students are fighting to get into his class if they have guts. If they don't have guts, they ran away to JTS. You know, give me a name of a nice yeshiva college graduate who ran to save his life from the awesome Rabbi Yeruchim Gilrelik and Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, whom he later writes about under the name Schaffman, sharp man, genius man.
Potak.
Chaim Potak, of course. Chaim Potak ran away, the rest are clamoring to get in. Rabbi Belkin, distant figure. Rabbi Rubin, how many times did you see Rabbi Belkin? How many years were you uptown? 4 years of college, 3 years of smicha, 7 years after you finished Maimonides in Boston. How many times did you hear Rabbi Belkin speak? I'm waiting for an answer.
Maybe three
in 7 years.
It's very tragic.
You're reading me very well, but listen to this source. Listen to this source. One morning, the president entered an elevator crowded with students going to classes. He turned to one student and asked, "Do you know who I am?" The student studied the man next to him for a moment and answered, "No, but you look familiar." Dr. Belkin turned his head away and began to cry. Can anyone tell me who was the student who experienced this? The greatest builder that YU ever raised. You all know him, Reb Shlomo Lariskin. Note 10, interview with Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, April 24th, 2002. What a story. Can you picture it? Crowd of students. Do you know who I am? And Riskin, he caught your attention because Steve was short. He was something short. You know, he got what... He didn't get lost in the crowd. He stood out in the crowd because he was short. His eyes, Steve, even as a student, we used to call him the boy wonder. Stevie Wonder. Remember that singer? We used to call him Stevie Wonder. He had that terrific ability, speaking and dreaming and vision, even as a kid. You know his story, what he came from, and the father, the communist, and the other grandfather, and his grandmother. Oh, wow. What a story. The Schwitzbards, he tells it well. And Dr. Belkin turns to him. "Do you know who I am?" He says, "Yeah, you look familiar. Here's the man, the president, the Rosh Yeshiva. The whole institution stands on his shoulders." Very sad, very sad. But there was little he could do. Time, the precious of life. And here I want to say something very important. And to a certain degree it's true of Dr. Revel. These men had tremendous minds. They could have become tremendous scholars. And they gave it all up because the vicissitudes of life, the quests of life, the challenges of life were overwhelming. The name Professor Harry Wolfson mean anything to you? Wolfson was perhaps the most famous professor that Harvard had. Who was Wolfson? Wolfson was a Telos Yeshiva boy. He knew all of Shas, he Greek and Latin and philosophy, and he taught at Harvard. He was a character. It's worth reading about Wolfson. He never married. And his escape from life was he loved movies. So he'd work all day in learning and writing and teaching and doing what he had to do, editing, getting his books ready. And then he'd knock off, catch the late show of a movie. There was no television yet, no computer yet. Not like today, you sit at home and the whole world is at your fingertips. So he'd go to the movies and he'd fall asleep. When the cleaning crew came in the morning to clean out the movie, they knew they would find Professor Wolfson asleep. They would gently wake him up. You know, they all knew this was a world-famous professor. They gently wake him up and tell him, it's 8 a.m. now. It's not that the movie is long since over. So he, Professor Wolfson, got to know Dr. Belkin through the Rav. In other words, that was the mutual contact in Boston. And Wolfson remarked to Rabbi Wurzburger. Rabbi Wurzburger was a rav in the Boston area at the time. Rabbi Dr. Walter Wurzburger, one of the rav's top talmidim out of the 1940s, and he remarks to Rabbi Wurzburger, what a loss for scholarship that Dr. Belkin became president of the yeshiva. Had he remained in scholarship with Philo, Greek, Latin, there's no telling what he could have done, what he could have accomplished. And by the way, the same thing is true of Rabbi Revel. Rabbi Revel was a tremendous Karaitic scholar, but after his doctorate, very rarely could he get back to scholarship. Because you have to remember, for these people, and for all of us who are B'nai Torah, it's icing on the cake. In other words, the heart of what we have to make time for is Shas and Paiskim. Ah, then if you have your more claim, you can go beyond it. But these were people who barely had time for Shas and Paiskim once they got involved with all their responsibilities. Okay. Tremendous price. A heavy price. And let me say something further. It affected Dr. Belkin's entire gestalt. The burden of the yeshiva, the finances, the responsibility, the pressure, the tension, the salaries being paid on time, which we spoke about. And by the 60s, Dr. Belkin, you felt, oh, this poor man. To use a Hebrew expression from the yeshiva shevelt, as given a shevakli, you felt his physical structure is breaking down. And Dr. Belkin was constantly smoking, and there was always liquor. And his own family, he got divorced, which was unheard of. Married a very elegant, wonderful woman, second but first wife too, I understand, fabulous. But evidently she was not geared for Dr. Belkin already, university president, and who he had to meet with and who he had to speak with and the affairs that he had to go to. And all this is true. And I always have a fear that maybe one of the reasons that no one has ever written a doctorate in Rabbi Belkin is that they're afraid these details will come out. So I want to say something. A mensch bleibt a mensch. A human being is only a human being. We all have frailties and we all have failings. When you write about Rabbi Belkin, this has to be mentioned. You can't leave it out because it's too well known. And you don't want to leave it out because it can be written in a very positive fashion. That the man was so meisa nefesh for the yeshiva, for building, for constructing, that the difficulties of the fundraising, particularly the fundraising, ultimately affected his health. Nothing wrong with that. Ultimately affected even his personal happiness. personal life. And you don't have to go any further. But, you know, the yeshiva was small at the time compared to today. Dr. Belkin's office was right in the public thoroughfare of the main academic center. Later, it's moved to a more secluded spot when first hall opens. But everyone knew, everyone saw, and everyone knew Dr. Belkin. And those who understood, it was a feeling of gratitude for what he accomplished, but a feeling of sadness for the personal price that he had to pay. And this has to be stated, but stated in a constructive fashion. And I can tell you, you talk about Rav Aaron Cutler, don't forget what I said in class last week or 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, and this is hitting the nail on the head. You talk about Rav Aaron Cutler, he paid a tremendous price for building Lakewood. There was no time left to be Rav Aaron Cutler. Basically, his shayurim and all that he was able to give over to the Talmidim was based upon what he accomplished in Europe, what he learned in Europe, what he studied in Europe, what he was machadesh in Europe, what he taught in Europe. The seven-year cycle, I told you, the Rav was so fortunate that God did not answer his prayers, not in relation to Vilna in 1930-31, not in relation to the presidency of the yeshiva. The Rav was able to sit and learn. I have in the Rav, word by word, quoting Rebbe, "My wife is witness," he says, "that at times I don't go to bed till 1 a.m., 2 a.m., because I have to prepare my shayurim for the students I will have in the yeshiva." And he was fortunate. He didn't have that burden of fundraising. And that's what Rabbi Belkin promised him. "You will teach. I will handle the fundraising." And this is the way he cajoled the Rav to remain at yeshiva, not to go to Chicago in 1944, when the Rav very seriously considered Chicago. He wanted to leave Boston, not just YU. Boston was the Kashrut scandal that shocked him, that undermined him. And you have no idea. I told you, the Rav would come home and he'd say to his child, "How can people lie? How can people lie? If you live in Israel, you know what's going on today. The world is shaking. The world of Israel is shaking. The world of Ivrit Hamaduberet is shaking. Wow, what's going to go on today?" Shula Zakein is testifying. Moshe Talansky, the YU graduate, the YU Musmach, who saved the state of Israel, in my humble opinion, he has. He's a tremendous schuyat, because God have mercy, what Olmec would have given away, the Har Habayit, the Kotel, you would have needed a passport to go daven at the Kotel, if at all, God have mercy. Hey, leave out politics now. But the world, what's going to go on today? Wow. So, you have to understand, these two people, the Rav was fortunate. Dr. Belkin, on one hand, what he achieved, what he created, Yesh Meyayin, unbelievable. On the other hand, look at the price he paid. And you have to stand in awe of a man who could create so much, and yet the Atmos Nefesh overwhelming. And this is life. Rav Aaron Cutler, remember, for $5 bills he had to go schnorring, couldn't stay in Lakewood all week, had to come back to Brooklyn, but not coming back to Brooklyn to sit b'menuchat ha-nefesh and learn and seclude himself, but coming back to Brooklyn to go schnorring from door to door. In addition, Rav Aaron Cutler, Chinuch Atzmai, Agudat Yisrael, Torah Mesorah, he got involved on every level, and he created what is today right-wing Litvish Orthodoxy in America, Absolutely, one man created it. Not Reb Moshe Feinstein and not Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, but Reb Aaron Cutler. One man, his drive, his vision, what he believed in. But he paid a very heavy price. And I mentioned Reb Mordechai Gifter before. To me, it's tragic that a person who loved Eretz Yisrael so much and had such an insight what Eretz Yisrael is about and could have done so much here. He had to go back. And look what happened to Tells. It never took off again, at least in Cleveland. Never took off again. The branches became infinitely more successful than the mother, than the root, than the one who gave birth to them. So there's nothing to be ashamed of. But we're so used to art scroll where they write biographies, Ribbono Shel Olam. If you write the truth about Reb Chaim Moshe Grishinsky, you'll see that in his life there was unbelievable success and unbelievable frustration and akmas nefesh and tension. Ribbono Shel Olam, you write about anyone. No one has it all. No one achieves perfection. No one can say every moment I was on top of the ballpark, I was on top of the game. So if this is the reason that a doctorate has not been written on Dr. Belkin, I think it can be handled and be handled properly. Okay, now we come to the high point, the sad point. Okay, so this relationship we've spent already 2-3 weeks describing. I think you get a clear picture of it. And everything I've said is totally true until 1970. By 1970, Moriu Rebbe, the Rav's persona, as I alluded to before, had totally changed. Kol Zman that his wife lived, she was a very dominant force in his life. As the Gemara says in Masechet Nida, Bina Yeterah Ben Hashem. I once said this, it was picked up and recorded and went over the world, and a Talmud said to me, no, I give too much credit to women. I said, what do you want out of me? It's an open Gemara. Women have more insight than men. It's in this week's Seder, actually. I'll tell you a personal anecdote. When my wife and I worked for the Mossad, those 10 years, till the fall of the Communist Empire, so our handler was a great man, one of the greatest men, next to the Rebbe's, the greatest man I met in my life, Aryeh Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. I write about him, and he's been written about after the security clauses were lifted. And Ayako was, if you wanted to see someone dedicated to the continuity of the Jewish people 24/7, that was Ayako. And he was a rough guy. Yitzhak Rubin will agree with me. He was a rough guy. He was not an easy guy. He didn't tolerate. He was like the Rav. He didn't tolerate any baloney. The truth, cut away the fat within a minute. He was a rough guy, and he had opinions, and he ran a tight operation. I can go into more details, not for now. So, I.A. Kroll, who was the big influence in his life, his wife? He would say to me when we were discussing certain issues, we had to make certain decisions, and these were, I wouldn't say life and death decisions, but pretty close to it. It affected many souls, many individuals. So I would have one opinion, my wife would have another opinion. Aryeh Kroll, never a problem. Quote the Pasuk, Shma b'kol sarah, b'ini yotei rabban Hashem. When I finally met his wife, I was blown away. She was a Bekiah in Shas, what she knew, Tanakh, Mishnah. Turned out she, for many years, was in charge of the Limud of Torah Shebal Peh in the entire Negev, in the religion, in the Mamlachti Dati schools. She was the person in charge. That was his wife. I couldn't believe it when I finally met her. Wow, Then she spoke. I remember there was a meeting of the Mossad, and I was the only non-Mossad person who spoke, but she spoke and was blown away. So, you know, women have a certain insight that men don't have. The Rav spoke about, if you know the Rav's Torah on Esther Hamalka, right, the difference between Mordechai and Esther. Even when he speaks now, when I heard him this morning in my car, when he speaks about Miriam Hanaviyah, women have very big influence. There's no question that Rebbetzin Tanya was a dominant influence on the Rav. I often say she connected the Rav from his genius upbringing and his seclusion from the general populace, not having gone to a yeshiva like Rabbi Belkin or like Rabbi Zipperstein or like any other name you'll mention. She brought him into reality and helped him bridge that gap. It is my conviction that what happened in the early 70s would have never happened had the Rebbetzin been alive. She would have worked it out. She would have bridged the gap. That's one part of the story. She was not here. She was gone. And of course, the other part I alluded to before. We're all big shots when we can walk on our own, when we can speak on our own, when we get a good night's sleep, when we eat a good meal. We're big shots. By the 1970s, the Rav's health starts to fail. And he's more and more dependent on his students. The temper has long since disappeared. If you go back to the 1970s and Tunan on the teaching in BMT, there was no Kollel yet. But BMT had a lot of older fellows, had people to talk with on a high level. So I would say to them, the reports reaching me from New York that the Rav lost his temper and is so docile, do not make me happy. I would rather have the Rav a terror, because when he was a terror, we shaped up. If he's a little teddy bear, what the heck is going to be with his students when they get away with everything? Now, the Rav was dependent on his students. And let's be honest. Young people by nature tend to be more extreme. When it comes to the Har HaBayit, you notice they shut it down, anyone over 50. If we'll have bad incidents when we shouldn't have, you'll see they'll shut it down, no man allowed in under 40. I think there was once a time when they didn't allow anyone in under 30. And this is part of being young. Part of being young, you see life black and white. You do not see life gray. And we all have experienced this. I in my case, it's not too pronounced because at a very early age, I got my wings clipped and I got my ears chewed off and my nose punched in. And Baruch Hashem, I lost my front teeth. And at the age of 23, I was no longer young. I was a different person altogether, for better or for worse. Again, I think it's for better, but could be it was for worse, I don't know. But that was the Rav, and I got my first shtetl. I write about it, I've spoken about it, and I don't think that shul, I think if there are any old timers left, I think they're still mad at me from the machlekes back in 61. But that's life. That's life, Rafi. So young people tend to be extreme. Don't see gray. Now, what happened was very simple. Yeshiva, the budget had greatly expanded. And this is a problem. When you can't meet your budget and you have to be dependent upon outside forces, then mi sheyesh lo hameya yesh lo hadeya. It came up in Israel many times with Chinuch Atzmai when Rav Shach ran the world here, Rav Ephraim Menachem Shach, Zichrono Livracha, ran the Litvische Welt. it reached the point where the government gave more and more money to Chinuch Atzmai. At a certain point, Rav Shach was opposed to getting all this money from the government because you're totally subservient to the government. They will make the decisions. Core curriculum is a prime example. Today, if you don't introduce core curriculum, so you don't get full subsidy from the government. The government is putting tremendous heat on. It forces, even in Beit Shemesh, they have to bend. And in some of the schools, they have to teach core curriculum, even though it's al apam v'chamatam. In the late 60s, there was a mini depression in the United States, particularly 69. People who had a fortune of money, some of those people were worth hundreds of millions before, and after 69, they were worth tens of millions. Now, Alex, you might say, what's the difference if you're worth 200 million or 10 million? You're right. If I had $10 million, I don't need any more. I don't have a care in the world. But if you once had 200 million and you had the ability to give, to determine, to dictate, and now you're down to 10 fashlunken a million, it's a problem psychologically. Okay. Rabbi Belkin was more and more dependent upon outside funding, mainly from the United States government. At a certain point, 1970 to be exact, the New York State Department of Education advised the yeshiva that its existing charter contravened the laws that were state and federal forbidding financial assistance or grants to religious institutions. And this all goes back to separation of church and state, an issue that hangs fire until today and will hang fire as long as America runs in its current position and the Supreme Court and all the laws that are challenged and all the decisions that are made. If this is the case, yeshiva was advised by friends. These were not enemies. New York, very proud to have Yeshiva University, very proud to have Jews, plenty of Jews in politics, influential, but law is law, and they advised yeshiva they must change the charter. Yeshiva worked out with lawyers and came up with a whole new charter which made yeshiva a non-denominational institution. If I am correct, technically speaking, a non-Jew could apply to study at Yeshiva University at the undergraduate level. We're talking the graduate schools were always non-denominational. But a non-Jew could apply to study at Yeshiva College, of course. Then I'll have to take a course in the morning, either Yeshiva or the Yeshiva program or REITs or what do they call the other program? They used to call it the Erna Michael, the Erna Michael College, or give me a name that used to. What's IBC?
The Breuer College.
Now it's the Breuer College. Wow, they sell the name every 10 years. Got a couple of Jewish study program in my time. We'll come. Wait till we come to the Jewish studies program. You'll see what I. So you see now, what do you do with REITs? So REITs now becomes an affiliate of the yeshiva. Okay, my dear students. Just think for one minute. The kids in yeshiva, REITs is an affiliate. REITs is the heart of the institution. What are you doing to REITs? You're pushing it aside. You're pushing it away. Yeshiva College becomes the most important part of the undergraduate world. Yeshiva College becomes the heart of the yeshiva. Yeshiva College becomes the backbone of Yeshiva University. And it is a non-denominational institution. Everyone is welcome, irrespective, how does the words read, of religion, of ethnic origins, of gender. Today it would mean you can be a homosexual, you can be a lesbian, you're a transvite, there are other names, I don't know what the other things are. I saw there are more types of people around. God have mercy. And everything is accepted, everything is normative. I just heard last night that a cousin showed up in Israel. So my brother, I couldn't go. I taught yesterday. My brother had them over at his house. One of my daughters, I got a report from my youngest daughter when she's interested in family genealogy. So I got a report on what happened to the greater Fogel family since our grandparents came to America 120 years ago. Take my word for it, if I'm not sick this morning, it's only because I love my students and love Torah and already learned four Siddurim today, beginning at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's how I'm sitting here, Modela Kaddish Baruch Hu. So I have first cousins, once removed, who decided not to bring children into the world, then never married. Then I have first cousins, once removed, all married to Gentiles, raising their kids as Gentiles. Tell me, Alex, which is better, not to marry or to have kids raised as Gentiles? What do you say? Which is better?
No children.
No, I say just the opposite. First of all, there's a concept that even the Gentiles have to have children to fill the world.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Now, and secondly, look at it this way. If you have children, one day, God have mercy on us, their children, their grandchildren, go, who am I? Hey, wait, I have Jewish blood in me. What's mean I have Jewish blood? And these kids start exploring Zera Beit Yisrael. And let me tell you, I have met people who are tzaddikim, kedoshim, and their whole march to Yiddishkeit began because they had a great-great-grandfather who was Jewish. You follow me? So I think it's better than not having any, but this is the story. This is what happened. This is what you want to do to YU. This is the way you want to water it down. You want to turn Reitz into an affiliate. And the students were wild with anger. And who is Dr. Belkin? By this time, nobody knew who Dr. Belkin was. Nobody saw Dr. Belkin. Nobody had contact with Dr. Belkin. There wasn't one student around on campus who could say, I was a Talmud of Rav Shmuel Belkin. Students of the 30s, the early 40s, they're all gone. They're all out in the big world. Some are no longer alive. Rav Shmuel Belkin has been completely secluded. And they went after Rebbe. Rebbe, they're going to destroy the yeshiva. They're going to destroy Reitz. They're going to take the Torah out of Yeshiva University. It's going to be like any other school. How did Harvard begin? How did Yale begin? No, answer me. Theological schools. The great Yeshiva University, big deal, it has the name YU. It began as a theological school. But in 1970, you're changing the charter. You are shifting gears.
Did they understand that in order to get federal money, you had to write these things? What black person is going to go to Yeshiva?
Rabbi Rubin just took the next sentence out of my mouth, but before I begin, let me just... Eli Shustak. Eli, were you in class yesterday?
No. This is the class that I plan on attending.
This is... So, 1 second. I got to... Eli Shustak. So you're going to wind up thinking the Rebbe is a big Amoritz. You understand? That's what gets me upset. This class doesn't require Shas and Paiskim. Sunday's class, that's the yeshiva. This class is like Yale and Harvard. What's the big deal?
I don't think in Yale or Harvard the the teacher would know both talk about the world and talk about the Rabbi Kaplan.
It's okay. Yitzchak, thank you for defending me, but the Rebbe will survive either way. Avram Lida. You're in this class. Avram Lina. Okay, I don't have any Shmuel Segel. I have Yitzvik, Mori, Moshe Schwartz. So Moshe Schwartz. Moshe Schwartz. But Moshe B. Schwartz. That's the other. Alan Strauss, Mark Ora, Alex, Rafi, Jason Allen.
He's still in America. He'll be back, God willing, on Thursday.
Okay. Max Daniels. Beit Shemes, Yomo, okay. Avram. Gentlemen, Rabbi Rubin hit the nail on the head. There's another side of the coin. At times, we have to fit into a certain pattern to survive. But changing the charter and making Reitz an affiliate doesn't mean that Reitz is being pushed aside. It just means that legally, to qualify for endless hundreds of millions of dollars over the years, perhaps billions of dollars by now, we have to accept the rules of the American government. If I can make an analogy, imagine you're sitting in a meeting now of Kinech Atzmai, and they're debating whether to allow the core curriculum, in modern Hebrew, a new word, tochnit haliba. That's the word in modern Hebrew. New Rafi, can you imagine people are saying, we'll allow in tochnit haliba, chas v'chalila, will undermine the Torah, it will destroy everything we believe in. It, until now we have functioned Torah only. Why do we have to get involved with the German concept, with the YU concept? They're a bunch of shkatzim anyway. They have totally failed in producing Urayim Vishleimim. We want no part of Tachnit Halipa. Well, the other side of the coin would say, look, where are we going to get the hundreds of millions of dollars? So we'll have a Tachnit Halipa. We know endless good Jews who know mathematics, no English, no computers, and they don't fail to daven in a minyan three times a day. They don't fail to make a Siyum Shas every 7 years. What is so schlecht? What is so bad? You follow? And the students were wound up, God forbid. Now, I am convinced that the Rebbetzin been alive, this would have never exploded. But Rebbe was totally dependent upon his students physically and even beyond the physical reality. They had his ear. They had his ear. Rabbi Belkin, no one even knew who he was. If Rabbi Riskin couldn't recognize Rabbi Belkin, Dr. Belkin, in the early 60s, riding up an elevator, it probably the elevator could have either been, by that time they had an elevator, you know what happened, First Hall had an elevator, so Ms. Davram said, we need an elevator in the main academic center, Lama Nigara, and they built an elevator in the main academic center. I remember, oh wow, that was a big moment that there was an elevator. I think at first only faculty was allowed to use it, students who had disabilities. But the Chamon Am was not yet allowed to use the sacred elevator in the main academic center. And if in 61, 62, whenever it happened, Rabbi Riskin, Steve Riskin, a kid, let me not give him titles yet, when he was a little kid yet, that he didn't recognize Rabbi Belkin, Dr. Belkin. What do you want out of the masses of students in the early 70s? They had no idea. Dr. Belkin was so distant already, so removed. The decade of the 60s was very difficult for Rabbi Belkin. He had expanded the yeshiva. There was already Stern College. There was already Albert Einstein Medical School. There was Belfield Graduate School. And there was so much happening and so much growing and so much doing. And the budget... And then recession, and Dr. Belkin was dependent upon state and federal funds to keep the ship afloat. And what happens, of course, is very sad. It's a tragic moment in the history of Yeshiva. And we'll pick up with that tragic moment next Monday. Be'ezrat ha'natengel yavkoch. Yes, Eli, wag it out.
Do you think that that it was just the fact that the Rebbetzin passed away that the thing blew up, or was also the nature of the students that the Rebbe was dealing with in the center?
The nature of the students. You're right. That the fact that there was the start, it wasn't already in all its glory, but there was a more right wing tendency. But nevertheless, it's my own feeling. I may be wrong. I don't think this can be proved. But it's a theory that I hold very strongly. When you have a theory, you can't say you're 100% right. Understand? It's something Professor Yoshua Finkel taught me. Never say you're 100%. 90% is also good. But had the Rebbetzin been alive, she would have kept the situation calm and would have told. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see what the Rebbe says, Mr. Rabbi Belkin. What would you say may be partially correct? There is some input to that, that the student of the 60s was not the student of the 40s or the 50s. For Haraya, you don't see students flocking to JTS anymore. You follow? The 30s, 40s, even into the 50s and early 60s, I think it's 50% of the JTS graduates were Yeshiva College graduates. I mean, I don't know what the statistic, but it must be close to 50, if not above 50. Yes, Shmuley.
How long have I made the Rupshit?
Wait, I can't go slowly because your English is alien to me. Yeah.
Could it be the Rav shifted, meaning as the Rav got older,
The Rav didn't shift at all. That I've spoken about many times, and I prove it in the Rav. I quote, no, the Rav didn't shift, but he was. It's sad. You're dependent. Thank God I function. I'm very good to my grandchildren. So whenever they thank me, I say to them, one day I may need you. I don't know whether they realize the depth of what I'm saying. Okay? Al kashlicheni li'et sikna. Okay? When I saw the Rav last in 83, the last time I visited his class. I was in America on Russian business. The last day I blocked out, I'm going to the shir. From there I went to the airport. I went to the shir, I walked Rebbe to his apartment, the apartment I stayed in last May, that's where I saw Rebbe. I sat, I spoke with him in learning, I asked him questions, I've quoted him in scholarship. His mind was fairly good that day. But it was pathetic. Lo aleinu vasved from a mensch. Do I have to elaborate? He couldn't stand up, the students had to help him stand. He couldn't walk, they asked me to take him on his right side. They were being mechabed me, you follow? As an old Torah. Already some of the people knew me, you know, an old-time student. Oh, so they were machaved me. I didn't understand what was going on. Lo aleinu, he couldn't walk on his own. He had no balance. The Parkinson's. Okay? You're dependent. You know the story with the bottle of milk. I've told it many times. Well, and off on the light. No, but I have to finish out of a lot here. With the milk, and this catches you. With the late 70s, so all his gaboyim were my students. So they told me afterwards, the Rav had ulcers, right? And he needed to drink a lot of milk. So he says, get me a quart of milk. And he gives them whatever, a dollar bill, whatever. And behind his back, the students start saying, what does he mean milk? Does he mean Chalav Yisrael? Does he mean regular? Who would have ever used the word Chalav Yisrael in the 1950s? Get me a quart of milk. And the Rav hears them. He says, a quart of milk. Delwood milk. Delwood was O-U-D. Chalav Stam, Chalav Akum, Stam Chalav, whatever you want to call it. You understand? So that captures what you're saying, and it captures what I'm saying. You understand? It's the Rav. That's the reality. Zelechud v'zelechud. The Rav didn't change, not at all. He couldn't tolerate the swing to the right bothered him. I've spoken about it many times. Reread, I can't elaborate now. Read the Rav by my good friend Aaron Ratcheff. It's worth, you can't read it, you have to study it. Washington, you can read on the lower level, but the Rav, you can't read even on the lower level, has to be studied. What do we do today? All right, an honest to the best of one man's ability, an honest description of the Rav and Dr. Belkin. It is sad. In other words, you look at the Rav, who was not the quintessential Rebbe that students want. Rabbi Belkin was the quintessential Rebbe that students long for. And yet, look how life works out, that the Rav becomes the Rav, and ultimately he becomes a sugar daddy. The 70s, what a different Rebbe than the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. But Dr. Belkin, ad kedei kach secluded, that does anyone, do you know who I am? And Rabbi Rishkin says, you look familiar, but I don't know your name. Could you imagine if Rabbi Belkin turns aside and cries? And building and accomplishing, don't forget, never forgot his East European roots. We'll come back to that next week, Bezrat Hashem, as well. The Kolel, Rabbi Victor Zipperstein, what a story. My dear students, next week we pick up exactly where we left off, both in Sunday and in the Monday class. Sunday class, very fascinating material. This is for Charlie. Someone went into Kahala, Dr. Shurin, this Yom Kippur, and he was blown away by their service, by their dignity. See if you recognize it. This is for Yitz, follow up, much more material on Rabbi Prusansky, the RCA, the tragedy out of Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, those of you that are Hasidim, for the first time, there is now a Hasidic Rebbe who all his followers wear kippot srugot under their shtreimels. And this article, I have to thank the people who sent it to me from Bamishpacha, and the follow-up, I have to thank Aryeh Liebman, my dear student. He knows how to make the Rebbe happy. You know who this man is? Who this Rebbe is? Do you know how it solves endless problems for me? Aryeh Kroll, always would talk about him. And now I got the whole story, I put it all together. This is the Ruzhna Rebbe's Anemical. His wife is a sister of the Vishnitzer Rebbe who just died. She is the aunt of the present Vishnitzer Rebbe. She is the sister of the Satmar Vishnitzer Rebbe in Muncie. He's more extreme than the Satmar even. That's in Muncie. That's her brother. This couple, they each as individuals, I don't think they were married yet, weren't married, survived the Holocaust. They met, they married. They became chalutzim. This is the Vishnitzer Rebbe's sister. The previous Vishnitzer Rebbe, the two removed, was her father. They lived in an irreligious kibbutz. At a certain point, they moved to a religious kibbutz, Kibbutz Sad, which you all know about, Otef Aza. Aryeh Kroll, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, was a member of Kibbutz Sad. That's how they knew each other. This individual, who was a farmer, a kibbutznik, his wife, he with the biggest yichus in the world, now moved to Gilo, and in his 90s became a Hasidic Rebbe, continuing the traditions of his family and her family. They have a tremendous crowd around them. His son, the Rebbe's son, is the highest ranking religious Jew in the IDF. He is a brigadier general. Look at the uniform, look at the rank. I know all about him from reading B'Machaneh. He is in charge of the entire miluim aspect of the army. Miluim, what's the word?
Miluim, reserves.
Reserves. The reserves that are called up from the army that fight the wars, my grandson, etc., He is the general in charge, brigadier general, son of the Rebbe, will succeed him one day as the next Rebbe. Here, they sent me more pictures. We can't get enough of the Pashkana Rebbe. That's the name he goes by. With endless pictures. Look at the kids who come to him. It is inspiring. Wow. This is a dream. A shtreimel with a kippah shtuka. Why you Chabad Club expands. Anyone who loves Chabad, I can't believe this article. What's going on in YU? They have, looks to me, tens and tens, if not hundreds of kids who go. The Young Israel of Century City, their program for the year. It's amazing what Rabbi Muskin can accomplish, what Rabbi Muskin can do. Very fascinating, and if you watch who the speakers are, it puts your pulse of them. You follow me on what's happening in RCA, YU Orthodoxy out in the field. The latest issue of Jewish Action, also indicative of our times, the new Orthodox entrepreneur. You got to read the article to believe it. Believe me, Rabbi Belkin will have no fun, no problem raising money if these guys take over the world and make the billions they want to. Also, there's a gallery here of Shana Tova cards. Oh. Beautiful, beautiful artwork. I have to say, Jewish Action comes out 4 times a year, but each issue is worth waiting for. My dear students, Nekavela B'sora Tovet Yeshuot Menechamot Aleinu V'al Kol Yisrael Refuah Shleima for Yehuda Yehoshua Ben Ita Grindel, known to you as Yehuda Glick, who, as I told you yesterday, his brother was a student in this very kollel, one of my best students ever, Yitzi Glick. Until we meet again in health and happiness in the Brav my heart, I thank you for coming and giving me the spice of life to teach such inquisitive faces. Until we meet again, Das Vedanya. Morty, one more week away, am I right?
Okay. Next week, I'm traveling for a Western fellowship thing. They're flying me to America.
Give my regards to the United States and tell the Yankees they're a bunch of phonies. Okay? Don't forget.
Shalom, Rabbi. Okay. Rabbi, you know Abby was Nefteris this past year.
Yeah, she was Nefteris in May. I was there in the States, but it was very strange. The funeral was 3-4 days after she died. I don't know why. I never was able to get an answer why.
I guess I'll ask my uncle.
She was finally buried the day I flew back to Israel. But I don't know why.
Was that the Mishpacha article that I told you about?
Yeah.
It was an interesting article, right?
Yeah, very interesting, but not only that. I now made the whole connection to Kibbutz Sad. Now, the question is, were they religious when they were in the Shafim and the other kibbutz?
The family?
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems from the article that they were.
No, the article, Mishpacha, you can't depend upon the truth. Apart from me. Where you live it. I don't know.
No, my father knows somebody who's a journalist who said on their articles like this, they do a lot of research.
I hope so. Yeah, but they don't say.
Did you read the article on Ogetz? I read one article from them. I read the article on Rav Schechter. That was enough for me to...
No, they once wanted to interview me, so I... On Russia, they wanted me to be part of a panel.
Can I take this?
Yeah. It's yours. They wanted to be part of a panel.
Oh, sorry.
So I was a chutzuf. I told them, I don't like to be part of a panel because people talk, they don't know what they're talking about. I said, if you want to interview me personally and then do what you want with it, I'll be very happy to tell you the Mossad part of the Russian operation. That I know backwards and forwards. I've published, the Mossad published about me, and there's not one correction in what I published in Washington. Not one correction. The Mossad went through with a tooth comb. So they never got back to me. You follow? So, say that someone signed you something.
My father hates, my father was in one interview for like 2 articles for the New York Times.
Right.
And after the second one, my father was never being interviewed by you again. And it was a...
That's an old issue.
You asked about Yitz. He is Yitz Glick. He still is commuting. He goes 2 weeks there and he's 2 weeks, here. Yeah, he runs the Efrat.
So my brother has told me he thinks he's here all the time. That's
no,
my
not.
Brother.
No,
was
I just saw his father-in-law this morning and I asked him.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
What does everybody think of Rev Krasinski's reason for stepping down?
I don't know what's going on. He's I can't come.
What did he do?
I can't in
New Jersey. I can't come in because I don't.
No, he said. He said there's nothing wrong with the Bezin.
He is worried.
He's upset about two things.
Watered down.
He's upset. He's upset that they're going to water it down, and it's caving into public pressure.
Right.
When it was just one person who messed up and not the system.
Right.
And he's also said that he doesn't like living in a world where that he needs a watchdog because the assumption is that he's a pig and all rabbis are pigs.
What happened in Washington is beyond words.
It's true.
Beyond words.
What do you think about the?
He compares the Jewish week to.
What do you compare it to?
He compared the Jewish week to the lead Nazi propaganda.
Spiegel. Oh, the Stummer.
Yeah,
I just gave it to you.
No, but I mean, it wasn't like straight up. He said the Jewish week and the Stummer have in common they both like writing about Jews. It's not good company to be in.
Yeah. But anyway, Steve generally he knows what he's doing.
My uncle.
But I don't know what's going on there. I hesitant. Of course, Mark Dratch should know what he's doing too. But Dratch is probably subject to pressure.
No, but he's much more left-leaning than...
Say that one is right of center, one is left of center. But Dratch, as far as I know, should be reliable. You follow me?
Do you know who's on the committee? At least all the Rabbanim that I saw are on the committee. I don't know all of them. Rabbi Reese is on the new committee. Rabbi Top, the common Top.
He's a good person.
Yeah.
He's the best Jacob.
Yeah, him. And then who else is on there? A couple. I mean, they seem like...
Yeah, Lechnish Kain Hanik, best Jacob is a difficult shoe. You know why it's difficult? Because you have 100 billionaires there who think if they can make $1 billion, they know more than anyone else. There is some truth to it, but, it's bad for a rabbi. Unless the rabbi comes in having made $1 billion. By the way, Krasinski is independently wealthy. You know that. His family. He was the lawyer for his family's real estate. His grandparents were wealthy.
No, he was but I don't think he didn't do real estate law. He did criminal law.
Criminal Nachbessa.
No, we weren't doing the DA.
Nachbessa. No, but I know that I believe he helped his family. Whatever. They owned a good part of the Bronx. Of course, a lot of that real estate became valueless. But in recent times, it's resuscitated. They're very good people. I was very close to his uncle who died young. Wally is his father.
Right, Wally's
father. What was his uncle's name?
I don't know. I'm related on the other side.
He left a widow, Sybil. She remarried. They were daughters from the first marriage. Very sad. Died of cancer. He was, I don't think he was 30 yet. We grew up together. I yet knew Steve's great-grandparents. You're talking Dorotor. You know how they got the name Prusansky? It's from Prusana.
Prusan, yeah.
His elder Zayda was Rebellia Prusana's Shoichet.
So that's Prusan with a P?
Yeah.
Not Brija.
No, Prusan with a P. Prusana.
They pride themselves that they're they're part of Karpas.
What do you mean, Karpas?
Or it was a part of these Karpas, the four towns in Europe that were snagged against the Hasidim, hardcore.
Hasidim won out. That's nothing to talk. If the Wayu Mashgiach is Rav Moshe Weinberg, what do we want?
Not the Mashgiach.
But the Mashgiach.